From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the U.S. helped create Saddam Hussein, and can we fix Iraq after he's gone? We talk with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East editor. He co-wrote the cover story of this week's edition. We'll also talk about the international politics behind the UN resolution to send weapons inspectors back to Iraq. Also, our linguist Jeff Nunberg defends the word ain't. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld argued today for action against Iraq before the House Armed Services Committee. He'd barely begun his opening statement when he was interrupted by protesters. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Inspections, not war! Inspections, not war!
Two unidentified women stood chanting behind Rumsfeld in the hearing room, waving signs with the same anti-war slogan before Capitol Police led them away. On Monday, Iraq said weapons inspectors could return there immediately with no conditions, but Rumsfeld dismissed the protesters' demand.
There's obviously a misunderstanding on the part of those who think that the goal is inspections. The goal isn't inspections, the goal is disarmament. That is what was agreed to by Iraq.
Rumsfeld said President Bush has not yet decided on taking military action against Saddam Hussein, but he called on Congress to quickly pass a resolution allowing the president to enforce UN resolutions on Iraq. He said lawmakers should not wait for the UN Security Council to first take action. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Pakistan has announced the arrest of more Islamic militants, including a man suspected of organizing a car bombing that killed 11 French engineers and 3 Pakistanis in May. The government says it has arrested 7 Pakistanis who were described as most wanted terrorists. Police in Karachi also arrested 2 other men on suspicion of planning to assassinate President Pervez Musharraf. The arrest came less than a week after Pakistani authorities rounded up about a dozen foreigners, mostly from Yemen, on terrorism charges. Officials say one of those men is suspected of helping to plan the September 11th terrorist attacks. That man, Ramzi bin al-Shib, has been handed over to U.S. authorities. In an effort to avoid voting problems like those that plagued last week's gubernatorial primary, Florida is asking the Justice Department for help before November's general election. Tom Patton reports from member station WJCT in Jacksonville.
In a letter to U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, Florida Secretary of State Jim Smith said the state is reviewing the problems, and he's asking the Attorney General to take whatever steps necessary to help in that review. Smith is also asking the Justice Department to help election supervisors ensure a smooth general election. The state's top election official says the problems have shaken confidence in Florida's efforts to reform its election system. Last week's balloting was marked by equipment glitches and human errors that brought back memories of the 2000 presidential race in Florida. Most of the problems this year were concentrated in heavily Democratic Miami-Dade and Broward counties. The problems came despite a $32 million overhaul of Florida's election system that included the installation of touchscreen and optical scan voting machines. For NPR News, I'm Tom Patton in Jacksonville.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 35 points to close at 8172. The Nasdaq lost 8 to close at 1252. This is NPR News. Police in Britain say they're charging a computer programmer under the Terrorism Act. Mohammed Abdullah Azam was arrested in the town of Luton, about 30 miles north of London, along with 2 other men who've since been released. The British Press Association quoted police sources as saying that Azam was suspected of collecting information likely to be useful to terrorists. The 32-year-old computer programmer is scheduled to appear in a London court tomorrow. Tropical storm Isidore is getting stronger as it moves away from Jamaica and heads toward Cuba. Forecasters now say it could reach hurricane strength within hours. Ed Thompson reports.
Isidore's motion was slow and erratic as it churned along the southwestern coast of Jamaica. It drenched the island with rain as emergency workers tried to head off flash floods. The rain will continue as the storm makes its way toward Cuba, nearing the Cayman Islands on the way. Forecasters say Isidore could become a hurricane tonight. Its slow movement gives it opportunity to build in strength over the warm waters of the Caribbean Sea, so a hurricane watch for Cuba has been upgraded to a hurricane warning. Isidore should reach Cuba sometime Thursday. From that point on, forecasters say it could pass near Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula and head into the Gulf of Mexico. The core of the storm is likely to miss South Florida, but it could spread heavy rain over much of the state in the next 2 or 3 days. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson.
The U.S. trade deficit fell in July, in part because of strong exports of U.S.-built cars. The Commerce Department said the trade gap narrowed by 6% from the month before. The report said overall exports grew for the fifth month in a row. Even so, the deficit for the year is already swollen to $412 billion. That's compared with $358 billion last year. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christopher Dickey, wrote the cover story in the current edition of Newsweek. It's called How We Helped Create Saddam and Can We Fix Iraq After He's Gone. Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. We invited him to talk about that article, as well as the politics behind the new UN resolution to send weapons inspectors back into Iraq. Dickey thinks that President Bush's address to the UN last week was a significant turning point. It led to the resolution, which created a new diplomatic context where the U.S. is no longer acting unilaterally. My interview with Dickey was recorded yesterday afternoon. By the end of the day, it was clear that there was a growing rift at the UN. The Bush administration is pushing to pass a new Security Council resolution that would impose strict conditions on Iraq's compliance with weapons inspectors and threaten military action if Iraq did not comply. Russia, China, France, and the Arab nations are opposed to this resolution. We called Christopher Dickey this morning to see if he wanted to add any comments. He says his analysis remains the same. He adds the U.S. is still playing hardball with Saddam Hussein and wants that message to be clear. Does the U.S. still want to get rid of Saddam? Absolutely. Nevertheless, it continues to signal willingness to work within the confines of the United Nations. The U.S. will draw the line and continue to threaten to break away from the U.N., and likely will break away if it thinks the debate within the UN is becoming a time-wasting diplomatic exercise that protects the dictator instead of guaranteeing his compliance with all UN resolutions. Here's my interview with Christopher Dickey of Newsweek. How do you think the Iraqi agreement to allow UN weapon inspectors back into Iraq changes the equation for the possibility of war?
I think it marginally reduces the chances of war. But I don't think it ends the chances of war. I think that the U.S. administration feels that Saddam Hussein really is a clear and present danger to the security of the United States and to the stability of the world, and it wants to take him out. He has bought perhaps a little time by agreeing to have the inspectors back in, but I think the inspectors are going to pursue a very aggressive agenda in terms of going after every place that they think any kind of weapon is being developed or might have been developed in the past or might be developed in the future, and probably picking a few places just to show that they can go into those locales. For instance, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the inspectors very early on go knock on the door of a few of Saddam's palaces, which were previously off limits to UN inspectors.
So what are some of the possible scenarios you see coming out of the weapons inspection?
Well, I think that the Iraqis feel or believe that they can probably start to play the kinds of games that they played all through the 1990s and that ended with the showdown in 1998 where UN inspectors were pulled out, the United States and Britain bombed Iraq for about 4 days, and sort of nothing came out of it. I think that the Iraqis see this exclusively as a bid for time. But I don't think the administration is going to permit that. So I think as the Iraqis are going to start saying they don't agree with the composition of the group of inspectors, they're going to say that Americans involved are spies or other people are spies. They're going to try and start limiting the number of locations and the timing of the inspections. They're going to try and pull every string and sort of work every angle that they possibly can. I mean, this is just the way they do things. The question is, how is the U.S. and how is the United Nations going to respond when that process begins? Is the United States administration going to press for a situation where really the slightest infraction, even if it's open to interpretation, becomes a cause for war? If not, are we going to see a lot of give and take over a period of months and perhaps the window of opportunity for a major military operation start to close? If the United States doesn't start to, wants to go to war and doesn't start to commit its troops to combat by sort of March or at the latest April, then basically the window for fighting that war closes very fast.
Why does it close?
Well, because of the weather mainly. It gets so hot. Remember that if the United States goes to war, if the United Nations goes to war, if anybody goes to war against Iraq at this point, you have to expect that there will be chemical and biological weapons involved, which means that the soldiers are going to have to protect themselves from those weapons by wearing what are essentially airtight suits, which are uncomfortable under any circumstances, but if you're fighting in 110-degree heat, become virtually unendurable.
Now, does Saddam Hussein's willingness, he says, to let in UN weapons inspectors change the way other countries will line up in alliance or in opposition to the United States if the United States thinks that the weapons inspection is a sham and isn't satisfied with it, and the United States therefore wants to go forward with an attack against Saddam Hussein?
Well, let's step back for a second. Does the UN involvement change the way the American move is perceived? I mean, what happened last week is extremely important. The big fear in the world community, I think it's fair to say, in Europe, in Asia, certainly in the Arab world, among America's close allies, was that the United States was just going to barge ahead on this. I think President Bush was widely perceived in the Arab world, certainly, and in much of Europe, as a gunslinger who was on a rampage, who was out to get Saddam, that there was this weird kind of eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation going on, even with a personal note, because Saddam had tried to kill his father, that in a geopolitical sense, the Bush administration was going to reopen an era of colonialism by taking over the second largest reserves of oil in the Middle East. And that in terms of the Middle East peace process, the ideologues in this administration were seen as essentially representing the interests not even of Israel, but of the Likud party in Israel. All of those were very strong perceptions in Europe and in much of the rest of the world, which I don't think American audiences were really aware of. But certainly the Bush administration came to be aware of the fact that it would be very isolated moving against Saddam unilaterally, that people were not necessarily going to follow automatically, and that the five countries that border Iraq, all of which hate Saddam, were in the weird position of defending him against this image of a gunslinging American president. President Bush turned all that around last week. It was really a remarkable feat. It was a fantastic speech. The timing was right, the phrasing was right, and the message was right. The message was, we want to work with the United Nations if the United Nations will work the way it's supposed to work and live up to its own obligations. And that changed the frame of reference completely. So now that brings us to the point where the Iraqis, listening to the Saudis and others, say, okay, we'll accept something that we haven't accepted for the last 4 years, which is UN inspectors with unfettered access. In fact, unfettered access almost never existed during the inspection regime. And we'll go that extra mile as Iraqis to satisfy the United Nations. Well, that's great, but they have to live up to that commitment, and the Bush administration is going to say that they have to live up to the commitments demanded of them in 16 other resolutions before the one that's currently under discussion. It's an interesting move. It's a fascinating and extremely dangerous moment because you've got Saddam in a position where he sees a narrow ray of hope that he can survive, and that's what is motivating him to act. It's also what's protecting, I would say, protecting the world and certainly the United States from a sort of doomsday scenario in which he might use terrorists or other means to deliver chemical and biological weapons against American targets, either in the United States or abroad. He's got this moment where he thinks he can survive by taking these measures. The United States, meanwhile, has won international support for the pressure it wants to put on Saddam and possible war against him. So balancing all those elements is something that's going to be very critical, and we're going to see it play for the next several weeks, maybe even months, as each side maneuvers for advantage. But I think in the end, the U.S. will go to war against Saddam.
Let me see if I understand what you've just implied there, which is that if Saddam Hussein was confident that we were ready to go into Iraq and overthrow him, that he would supply biological or chemical weapons to terrorists who would attack America or other American interests. Is that what
Sure.
you just said?
Absolutely. Saddam is a very vengeful character. I mean, one of the reasons that a regime like Saddam's is so dangerous, as compared, for instance, to the regime that's currently in Iran, is that he answers to no one. He has no constituency outside his own head. And he personally is someone we know very well, based on long experience. We know that he is violent and vengeful, and if he thinks he can get away with it and survive, he will exact a price of pain on his enemies just in order to do that. That's why in 1993 he had no conceivable political goal to achieve by trying to murder the president's father when the first President Bush was visiting Kuwait after his retirement. That was pure vengeance.
Well, this is one of the confusing things about the predicament that we're in now. Are we just leaving ourselves exposed by kind of sending this invitation, you know, to Saddam Hussein, saying we expect to invade you sometime soon. In the meantime, we'll do the weapons inspection thing, et cetera. Are we inviting him to prepare his chemical and biological weapons to be used against us, either directly from Iraq or through terrorist friends that he might send them to?
Well, we are, and especially if we had continued to pursue the unilateral notion of regime change. You telegraph this blow. You say, Saddam, we're coming to get you. We're not going to stop until you're dead and out of office and your regime and everything you care about and believe in and everything that you've built up for yourself and your family these last many years is gone and obliterated. You're going to be history, Saddam Hussein. That's an invitation to this particular guy to strike out, to do something desperate, if he feels that that moment finally has come. It didn't strike anybody in Europe or the Arab world as a very smart policy. It seemed to be begging not only for a confrontation, but a potentially disastrous confrontation with Saddam. Now, and also at a time when we didn't really have the means of gathering good intelligence about where his weapons program stood. You know, Vice President Cheney and others in the administration have occasionally dismissed the work of the weapons inspectors. But almost everything you heard in President Bush's speech last week was based on the work that was achieved by the weapons inspectors in the first 5 years of the last decade. They found out a lot. They destroyed a lot. They eliminated Saddam's nuclear infrastructure. The reason that people talk about his ability to build bombs is because he still has scientists. But we don't believe that he has any substantial infrastructure to produce nuclear weapons at this point, and certainly not to produce fissile materials, to produce the stuff that's vital to the weapons, the plutonium or enriched uranium. So
but that was
a tremendous accomplishment.
But you're confident that he does have biological weapons and chemical weapons?
Well, this is the problem. Biological and chemical weapons are much, much easier to produce once you have the expertise. You don't need the kind of elaborate infrastructure that's required for nuclear weapons. And the infrastructure that you do need is much, much easier to hide. I was covering this question back in 1995 when the first revelations of a pretty massive biological weapons program came to light. And I talked to Ralph Achaeus at the time, who was then the head of the UN inspections program. And it was clear in conversation with him that they didn't really know how they could ever inspect to their satisfaction under the regime that existed then, that is the inspection regime that existed then, to prove the negative, to prove that there were no biological weapons in storage or in production in Iraq. So biological weapons, to the greatest extent, and after that, chemical weapons, pose a huge problem. They can be manufactured fairly quickly. The precursors for some of them are relatively easy to get. And if you're talking about a fairly low level of technology, chlorine or mustard gas, for instance, both of which are chemical weapons that Saddam used during the Iran-Iraq war, then you all of a sudden have something that becomes very hard to trace as well. If there were a cloud of mustard gas that settled on New York City sometime soon, we could guess that Saddam Hussein was responsible for it, but proving it would be very hard to do. Once the inspectors are in place, if they are doing their job and doing their job aggressively, then you start to compile again a very detailed picture of everything that can be discovered about Saddam's biological and chemical weapons program.
My guest is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. He co-wrote this week's cover story, How We Helped Create Saddam. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Christopher Dickey. He's Newsweek's Paris bureau chief and Middle East editor, and he co-wrote this week's cover story. Recently in Newsweek, you presented this scenario. The U.S. attacks Iraq. The war is short. Saddam Hussein falls more quickly than expected. The aftermath is far worse. Iraq splinters along ethnic and religious lines. Saudi Arabia follows as Mecca and Medina break away from the reign of Riyadh. The fall of the House of Saud is disastrous, ending decades of quiet partnership between Riyadh and Washington that had assured the flow of affordable oil. Whose scenario is this?
It's a very common scenario in the region. It's a scenario based on not only on the fractures that exist within these two countries, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, but it's also the broader elements of that scenario included the fall of almost every regime that's friendly to the United States. And that's just based on historical precedent. The Arab world is a collection of societies that have felt over a long period of time humiliated, sometimes by their own leaders, often by foreign leaders and colonial powers, and often extremely disappointed by the military machines that cost them huge amounts of money, and by the politicians who are constantly calling for war and then failing to deliver victory. If you have a situation where the United States unilaterally, in defiance of the expressed wishes of its own allies in the Arab world, were to go to war in Iraq, take out Saddam, and then occupy Iraq, which would probably be a necessary effort in order to stabilize the situation there, then you'd have a combination of humiliation for the cultures, complete failure for the leaderships, and destabilization of the region that would be felt for a very, very long time. A precedent was set, for instance, a precedent that you could look at is what happened after the 1967 war between the Arabs and Israel, the Six-Day War in which Israel defeated all the Arab armies deployed against it in less than a week. That was a very fast victory and very effective, but we're still living with the aftermath of that victory, not only in terms of what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank, but with the fact that one regime after another toppled in the wake of that humiliating defeat. And many of the great villains of Middle Eastern politics since then, Gaddafi, Saddam, Hafez al-Assad, came to power in the immediate aftermath of the 67 war and remained there as troubling factors on the international scene ever afterward. This time around, I think you'd see Islamic or Islamist regimes coming to power preaching the same line that in some quarters they've been preaching since 1967. This failure, this humiliation has come to you because you're too far from God. You have to listen to Allah. You have to listen to us as the voice of Allah. Thereby we can restore our dignity and eventually conquer this infidel civilization.
Okay, but say the surrounding Arab countries decide to join with the United States through the United Nations to create an alliance that forces out Saddam Hussein. If that happens, it's no longer a humiliating defeat for those Arab countries because they're actually part of the victors. They were part of the alliance that toppled Saddam Hussein. So does the scenario change if they're allies through the UN?
Yes, dramatically. Absolutely. It changes 180 degrees if we go in representing a coalition that's well-supported. It doesn't mean that the people in all these countries, that the masses of people in all these countries will necessarily support the war, but they won't feel the same kind of humiliation. It's very interesting if you go back and look at what General Schwarzkopf said after the Gulf War in 91. Many, many people, of course, asked why he and the coalition didn't drive on to take Baghdad and eliminate Saddam then. And he cites a number of reasons, all of which had a great deal of validity then, and many of which have a great deal of validity now. One of the first of his reasons was that the coalition that existed in 1991 was one of the broadest coalitions for military action ever organized. That was, for him, extremely important because it stood, for instance, in stark contrast to Vietnam, another war where the United States decided to go it alone. And Schwarzkopf said, here we had this great coalition in the Gulf. If we had moved on Baghdad, we would have lost most of our Arab support, and we probably would have lost the French as well. We would have had the British and the Americans going into Baghdad, occupying the country, probably in contravention of the Geneva Conventions, and then having to pay for an extended, open-ended, in fact, occupation of a hostile country and hostile territory. And that was not something they wanted to do in 91. And you have to ask yourself why the Bush administration, this Bush administration, would want to do that now, especially if it was in a position where it didn't even have the coalition to begin with.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. He wrote the current cover story, How We Helped Create Saddam. Dickey will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet, available October 2002. Open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East editor. We'll talk about the possible international repercussions of war with Iraq. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on why we need the word ain't. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. He co-wrote this week's cover story, How We Help Create Saddam and Can We Fix Iraq After He's Gone. We're talking about that cover story and about the U.S. plans for military action against Iraq. During the Gulf War, Saudi Arabia let the United States use Saudi Arabia as a military base, and our command and control was headquartered there. This time around, the Saudi said that we could not use their country as a military base, although very recently they seem to have changed their mind about that, although my impression is they'd let us use it in a much more limited capacity. What's behind this flip-flop in the Saudis' willingness to let the United States use it for a base?
Well, again, the Bush administration has handled the Saudi question very badly. When you have people leaking from the Pentagon briefings by outside experts that declare Saudi Arabia is America's great enemy in the Arab world, the Saudis take umbrage at that because they see themselves as being the United States' most valuable friend in the Middle East, bar none. And they feel, I've been talking a lot to Saudis in very senior positions recently, they feel very badly used by the U.S. government and by certain parts of this administration, particularly the people in the Pentagon. So I think they wanted to send the message to the Pentagon that it was going to have to think long and hard about how it was going to conduct this war without Saudi bases, because those bases were indeed extremely important in the first war with Iraq in 1991. They have continued to be very important in the war with Afghanistan as a command and control center. And the Saudis also put pressure on other neighbors of Iraq to do likewise, to limit the possibilities for the American military to use their territory. Now, to some extent, there's a two-faced game. To some extent, they're doing this publicly and still allowing other things to go on. But the message is basically, you can't do this without our cooperation. So you'd better listen to what we have to say about the political environment in which this takes place and the diplomatic environment in which this takes place. And I think that there are definite signs that the United States is listening now. I think that I know the Saudis were very pleased with the speech at the United Nations last week. And one way of showing that they are pleased is to reopen the issue of the American bases in Saudi Arabia and to say, yeah, you can probably use them if it's part of the framework that was established in President Bush's speech last week.
Now, the reason why some people in the Pentagon were leaking negative things about Saudi Arabia, I think, has to do with the fact that so many of the terrorists behind 9/11 were Saudis. They came from Saudi Arabia. And I think the U.S. government has felt that the Saudis' cooperation in the war against terrorism hasn't been as firm as it might be.
Well, actually, the FBI has consistently said that the Saudi cooperation was quite good.
Uh-huh.
And the CIA as well. It is true that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, and it is true that a lot of people in the Saudi public, and some of the royals in Saudi, have tried to deny that that meant anything at all. But you also have a lot of rethinking going on in Saudi Arabia where people are saying, no, that does mean something. That means that if we could produce 15 of 19 people who would be involved in a project as horrible as the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, then we ought to look at what's wrong in our own society. This is the kind of thing, by the way, that's appearing now in the Saudi press. So there's a rethink going on there that's probably very positive. But that isn't the reason that all this pressure is being put on Saudi Arabia. The reason the pressure is being put is because Saudi Arabia does represent a line of thinking in the Middle East that's diametrically opposed to the line of thinking that's also represented in the administration that's very pro-Sharon, pro-Likud, I wouldn't say pro-Israel because I don't think that's the case. I think it's very pro-Likud. And there's a sort of a showdown that you see played out all the time between essentially the Saudi I wouldn't say pro-Saudi, but the sort of the Saudi line and the Likud line in the administration, because after all, oil and Israel are the two dominant elements in American policymaking.
Are Arab neighbors of Iraq fearful of Saddam Hussein for the same reasons we are, or do they have different reasons?
Well, they are fearful of Saddam Hussein for similar reasons. I mean, certainly the Saudis would have to worry that he would eventually want to take revenge on them for their support of the United States during the Gulf War. There has been a blood feud between the Ba'athist Party of Saddam Hussein in Iraq and the Ba'athist Party of the Assads in Syria for decades. The Turks are not on good terms with Iraq. They're occupying parts of Iraq at various times in order to fight the Kurdish rebels of their own country who have taken refuge there. The Iranians fought an 8-year war that was one of the bloodiest of the century. So all of them hate Saddam. All of them fear Saddam. All would be happy to see Saddam out of the way. But the one thing that they fear more than any of that is the chaos of Iraq breaking into pieces. And since it was in many ways an artificial construct of colonialism after World War I, just like almost everything else on the map of the Middle East, there is a particular fear that it just doesn't have the legitimacy and coherence to hold together if you don't have an extremely strong and even brutal leader doing that job. So that's the concern. And it may be that the concern about chaos, it certainly is the case, that the concern about chaos by the people in the region or by the Arab countries and other countries bordering Iraq is probably much higher than the fear of chaos that exists inside the Beltway.
And again, it's the fear that if there's chaos in Iraq and fighting in Iraq, that will spread and create chaos in neighboring countries, and those regimes might fall as a result.
Well, it's a complicated picture because you've got precisely because of the way borders were drawn after World War I when the Ottoman Empire broke up, you've got, for instance, large Kurdish populations in Iraq, in Iran, and in Turkey, and a few in Syria. And the great fear of Turkey and Iran is that there will be some kind of really independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq that would have irredentist aims on both Iranian and Turkish Kurdish territory. That sounds incredibly academic, but it is the stuff of which very brutal wars are made in the Middle East. And in southern Iraq, the population is largely Shiite. It's Arab, but it's Shiite, as Persia is Shiite, and also as most of the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia, or province of Saudi Arabia, is Shiite, which is where most of Saudi oil comes from. So there's this concern that if you had a breakaway Shiite state in the south, it would either be influenced by Iran or, in fact, impact Iran, and it would certainly be a concern that it would impact the eastern province of Saudi Arabia and cause the breakup of the Saudi regime.
My guest is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. He co-wrote this week's cover story, How He Helped Create Saddam. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Dickey. He's Newsweek's Paris bureau chief and Middle East editor, and he co-wrote the cover story in the current edition of Newsweek. When we were talking off air, you described an essential paradox about Saddam Hussein and what to do about him. Could you describe that for us now?
Well, the basic paradox when you write or talk about Saddam Hussein, and if you follow him over the years, is that it's very easy to say how dangerous this man is, even how evil he is. And you can cite chapter and verse endlessly. The president barely scratched the surface in his speech. There have been many reports, and I've been to Iraq many times. You feel it. It's one of the most sinister environments you can imagine. And then, at the same time, when you look at, and you would think that the logic of a description of that kind of evil and that kind of danger is automatically, well, we've got to get rid of this guy. But then when you start to look at the consequences of getting rid of him, or at least getting rid of him and proposing regime change and carrying it out the way the U.S. administration had been talking about doing for most of the last year, all of a sudden you see a whole new set of dangers, the danger of chaos, the danger of regional destabilization. That's a recipe for holding back, for doing nothing. And that's essentially been the stalemate of the last decade. Everybody knew Saddam was horrible, but nobody wanted to take the risks involved in getting rid of him. And as a result, we've wound up doing nothing, and for the last 4 years, allowing him to defy the United Nations and defy the United States. And I think one has to give credit on balance to President Bush for trying to shake the world out of that immobilization, that sort of torpor in the face of what is really an evil and dangerous regime. But that doesn't mean that we should immediately endorse the idea of storming into Baghdad at an enormous risk, not only to the civilian lives of countless Iraqis, but to the lives of thousands of American soldiers, and raising the possibility of a prolonged occupation that could change the character of international politics and ultimately even the character of life in the United States if it required eventually, say, a reinstitution of the draft in order to keep the manpower levels sufficient.
Let's talk a little bit about your cover story, which you co-wrote with Evan Thomas in this week's Newsweek. The cover story is titled How Saddam Happened, America Helped Make a Monster. Your story opens with a 1983 handshake between Donald Rumsfeld, who's now Secretary of Defense, and Saddam Hussein. What was that handshake about in 1983?
In 1983, Saddam had been fighting for about 3 years against Iran. The United States at that point saw two great dangers, overriding dangers in the Persian Gulf. One was the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime in Iran, and the other was the possibility of Soviet expansion toward the Persian Gulf. The hope was that by establishing friendly relationships, helpful relationships with Saddam Hussein, the United States could help bolster his regime in its war with Iran and prevent him sliding too far into the lap of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviets and, to a lesser extent, the French were supplying almost all of his arms for his war with Iran. And that meant that essentially we had taken the path of what we thought of as the lesser evil. And Saddam was able to exploit that throughout his career and, in fact, to this day, in international fora and even at home, he's been able to say, I am the lesser evil. After me, the deluge. After me, chaos. Or if I fall, Khomeini takes over Iraq and rules the Persian Gulf. If I have to, I'll get in bed with the Soviets in the old days, maybe the Russians today, and the balance of power will change in the region. He's played all that very shrewdly, and the United States again and again played into his hands in the 1980s. To some extent, by not moving more aggressively to oust him in the 1990s, continued to support his survival.
Okay, so in the 1980s, when the Reagan administration was backing Saddam Hussein because it thought Iraq wasn't nearly as bad as Iran's threat, what did we give Saddam Hussein in terms of weapons intelligence?
We didn't give him weapons directly, but we shared a lot of satellite intelligence with him that allowed him to see very clearly where Iranian positions were, where Iranian troops were massing, and in some cases, almost certainly, to use poison gas against those Iranian troops. What had happened was, in 1980, at a moment when Saddam thought Iran was weak, when the Khomeini regime was fairly new, really only months old, he decided to invade Iran. to try and take over the south of the country. And he thought that the world would thank him for doing this. After all, at that point, the Iranians were holding American diplomats hostage in the U.S. embassy in in Tehran. And he overplayed his hand, as he very often has in his career. The world didn't back him at that point. The Iranians rallied against him and with a series of human wave attacks drove him out of the country. And then Khomeini said, I'm going to take you out, Saddam. You are a dangerous guy. You are a threat to Iran that is intolerable. Actually, if you look at it, Khomeini's position is not so different than George Bush's. You are a risk we can't afford anymore. So I'm not going to stop fighting, Khomeini said, until you are eliminated. And at that point, Iran was driving on Baghdad and on Basra, the two biggest cities in Iraq, and the U.S. decided to intervene to help Saddam stop the drive and to put him in a position to at least balance his power again against Iran and to prolong the war actually over the course of eight long and incredibly bloody years.
Now, you said we didn't directly sell arms to Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war, but we did permit Iraq to import dual-use equipment and materials from American suppliers. What was that decision about, and what's the importance of that decision?
First of all, on the question of arms, what we did in terms of tanks and heavy weapons was to facilitate shipments from other countries. We would, for instance, sell or give weapons to Egypt, and then they would give their old weapons or other weapons to Saddam and support him that way. So there was this sort of fungible weaponry trade toward Iraq. But the tilt became more and more pronounced. In 1987, in a really amazing incident, Iraq, or an Iraqi fighter plane, launched a missile against an American destroyer in the Persian Gulf, the USS Stark, and killed 37 American sailors, killed them with one shot. The United States, you would have thought, would have said, we don't want to have anything more to do with Saddam. Quite the contrary. The United States said, gee, we think that was probably an accident, but because the Persian Gulf is so dangerous, we're going to greatly increase our presence there, and we're going to use the force deployed there against Iran, Saddam's enemy. And that's what we did. From 1987 until the end of the war in 1988, the United States was regularly using its military forces in the Gulf to attack Iranian oil installations, Iranian patrol boats, Iranian mine layers, all of which were then trying to attack the United States as well. Essentially, it engaged on behalf of Iraq in that war until finally Khomeini gave up. Khomeini gave up his efforts to get rid of Saddam, and Saddam declared himself a victor because he'd survived with a lot of help from the USA.
Now, in your Newsweek cover story, you report that the United States made it possible for Iraq to get shipments of bacteria, fungi, protozoa that could have been used for chemical weapons.
And probably were in many cases.
I mean biological weapons, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yes, and probably were used for biological weapons in many cases. The kinds of cultures that were being sent out were for some pretty esoteric and horrifying diseases, and they were being sent to the Iraq Atomic Energy Commission. Why does the Iraq Atomic Energy Commission need biological cultures of different kinds of bacteria that are often used in biological weaponry unless it is indeed developing weaponry? And yet the U.S. Commerce Department consistently signed off on these shipments from 1985 through 1989, even after the war with Iran was over.
Now, were these shipments from private businesses in the United States, or was the government involved with this?
They were from private businesses, but the government had to approve the shipments, and it did. The Commerce Department looked at the shipments and said, okay. They were not big. See, coming back to the theme of biological weapons, we're not talking about extremely expensive commodities here. We're talking about things that cost, you know, a few hundred dollars in some cases, but that can be used to develop fairly quickly biological weapons if you have the experts in-house who know what they're doing.
You also report that the State Department approved the shipment of 1.5 million atropine injectors for use against the effects of chemical weapons, but the Pentagon blocked the sale. What are the implications of that?
Well, when you start to order atropine injectors in that quantity, it suggests that you're going to be in an environment where there are a lot of chemical weapons floating around. And what we knew by then is that it was Saddam himself who was most likely to create that environment, who was using chemical weapons. He had used them against the Iranian human wave attacks in southern Iraq. And in 1988, he used chemical weapons against civilians in villages in northern Iraq, Kurdish civilians in northern Iraq. The most egregious case being around the town of Halabja. I'm sure you've seen, and many listeners have seen, those horrific photographs. And we ran one in Newsweek as well, of little children murdered by Saddam using chemical weapons in 1988. And the American reaction at that time, the reaction of the U.S. administration, the Reagan administration, was probably it was Iran that did it. And it was only under considerable pressure and a lot of information to the contrary that the U.S. administration finally conceded, no, it was Iraq killing its own people.
Christopher Dickey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. He co-wrote the current cover story, How We Helped Create Saddam. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on why we need the word ain't. This is Fresh Air. Ain't. It's a perfectly innocent contraction, yet there's no word that carries a bigger social stigma. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to how educated people use the word and has these thoughts about why it's unlikely that ain't will ever be rehabilitated.
It was exactly 40 years ago that the New Yorker ran a cartoon by Alan Dunn that showed a receptionist at the Merriam-Webster Company saying to a visitor, "Sorry, Dr. Gove ain't in." I don't know how many people would get that reference today. But at the time, most New Yorker readers would have known that the Dr. Gove in question was Philip Gove, the editor of Merriam-Webster's massive third New International Dictionary, which had been published a few months earlier. By any standard, Webster's Third was a monumental work of scholarship. But it stirred up a storm of controversy over what people considered its permissive approach to usage. More than anything else, what outraged the critics was that the dictionary declined to label the word ain't as colloquial or substandard, noting that even cultivated people often use the word in speech as a contraction of am not or is not. That was all it took to open the floodgates. The New York Times described the dictionary as a Bolshevik document, and the Chicago Daily News took it as the symptom of a general decay in values. And a columnist for the Toronto Telegram called the dictionary's acceptance of ain't a shameful business. "It's one of the ugliest words in the English language," he said, "and I want no part of it." Those fulminations sound a little over the top to us today, but then this was 30 years before the phrase lighten up entered the English language. Nowadays, there's probably nothing a new dictionary could include that would cause a major national scandal, certainly not to the point of inspiring a cartoon in the New Yorker. Yet ain't is no closer to being standard English than it was then. In the upstairs, downstairs world of language, ain't is still required to use the servant's entrance. There's always been something a little odd about the stigma attached to ain't. The word's been around since the 17th century, and for a long time nobody thought it was worse than any other contraction. Writers from Swift to Tennyson used it in their letters and speech in a completely unselfconscious way. It wasn't until the middle of the 19th century that critics started to condemn the word and made the avoidance of ain't the emblem of middle-class linguistic fastidiousness. The English upper class hung on to it for a while longer. Winston Churchill regularly used it in conversation, and Dorothy Sayers was always putting it into the mouth of her aristocratic sleuth, Lord Peter Wimsey. But by the time Webster's Third appeared, not even the swells were using the word in honest. Actually, though, it's hard to see what makes ain't more objectionable than any other contraction, particularly when it's short for am not. In fact, the aversion to ain't I is so strong that people have invented the absurdly ungrammatical aren't I as an alternative, as in, aren't I sure are. That's a pretty desperate expedient just to avoid using ain't, and grammarians from H.W. Fowler to William Safire have urged that it's time for ain't I to be accepted as standard English. But even with dictionaries and grammarians pleading for its rehabilitation, it isn't likely that ain't will be allowed into the drawing room of the language anytime soon. It isn't just that educated people disapprove of ain't in other people's speech, but that they find it so useful in their own. Of course, educated speakers have always used ain't when they feel like a little linguistic slumming. But in recent years, I'm hearing them use it more and more in a different way when they want to suggest that a fact is just obvious on the face of things. A while ago, a friend sent me an article from the Chronicle of Higher Education that quoted a dean at an Eastern university, "Any junior scholar who pays attention to teaching at the expense of research ain't gonna get tenure." That ain't was a nice touch, I thought. It made it clear that the dean's conclusion wasn't based on expert knowledge or some recent committee report. It was something that should be clear to anybody with an ounce of sense. That's the message that ain't conveys in all those common expressions like, "It ain't over till the fat lady sings," or, "If it ain't broke, don't fix it." Ain't tells you that this is a nitty-gritty verity that you don't need a college education to understand. The language is full of sayings that use ain't like that, and they'd all lose their populist pizzazz if you try to put them in standard English. It is not necessarily so. You haven't seen anything yet. Hit them where they aren't. That isn't hay. But educated people couldn't keep using ain't that way if the word wasn't considered a mark of uneducated speech. And it turns out that educated people use the word an awful lot. There are more than 4 million web pages containing ain't, almost all of them put there by authors who know full well that the word isn't supposed to be standard English. It gives you a sense of why we all have an interest in keeping ain't from becoming a respectable linguistic citizen. What would we use to do our dirty work for us? It ain't gonna happen.
Jeff Nunberg is a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Love makes me treat you the way I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? There's nothing too good for good, so true. Mama, ain't I good to you?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, A Congregation Searches for Its Leader by Stephen Fried. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Charles Heyman, the editor of Jane's World Armies, and Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, talk about the war on terrorism and the possibility of war with Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.